So I'm Gary Berg for us, along with my co-chairs here, Mike and Andrea. We're going to give a three-part conversation here about the semantic content reuse, which should be coming up shortly. So I'll do the first part of this and then pass it over to Mike, who will pass it over to Andrea. So loading. So here we are. Let's see.
See the slide number?
Okay, so this introduces the topic, which is track A, semantic content reuse. Notice that we're out of order, so A, we thought we would be among the first presenters. So some of our information sort of has been well covered, so you'll be familiar with you. So to begin with, this is a summary of what we did. Like other tracks, we had two sessions of presentations, January and March. We had a very extensive email dialogue on the forum about some of these topics. We have a discussion and community page, which you should look at. The links are in the summit pages. And we started out with track A goals, which is to define the conditions for reuse of semantic content. This included things like concepts as well as what was called here meta-ontologies, which are essentially linking ontologies, ontologies about other ontologies and maybe connections between them. We had the idea of approaching this through discussion of modularization, and we wanted to cover best practices. And in particular, we wanted to talk about design patterns. So one of our early speakers covered the idea of ontology design patterns. Again, these are all things that you've heard a little bit about. And we also recognized that there would be an important role for things like tooling, including ontology repositories, which are not mentioned before. So that was sort of our beginning. We evolved over time as we went along, but here was our sort of going in idea about how this track related to the overall topic for the symposium this year. Again, Mike covered this well in his introduction, the idea that semantics plays an increasing role within big data and linked open data. We wanted to, as part of our mission, to leverage common semantic content in order to reduce the burdens of building new quality ontologies without having to build them from scratch and avoid some of the difficulties of different ontologies and may be able to bring them together. As I say, that's the meta-ontology idea. When we were talking about semantic content, we defined a very broad range going from top-level ontologies, very extensive ontologies, to modular ontologies, to patterns, and so forth. And we recognized going in that the idea that there would be, we would want to talk about some methodologies for constructing these things, the idea of bottlenecks and issues, and also tools that has been discussed before. We saw that it is highly interrelated. So, slide four. I've got a good hand signal on that. As we started, I gave actually an overview of some of the issues, and I used this particular slide, which is sort of like the picture of the big data landscape. And you don't have to read all the things here. You recognize there are going to be things like big computing structures and platforms. There's going to be the cloud in there. There's lots of analytics, and our speakers covered lots of analytics. But you don't find semantics in this particular sort of slide. So the idea was that while inside efforts, people recognize the need for semantics, for semantic interoperability of data, to a large extent, in some places, it's being ignored, certainly in some funding and looking at the landscape via Gardner, at least, it would seem to be ignored. Here's a slide I also used in part of my early introduction, which is to actually look at a particular a big data effort. This is in the case of hydrology, as it mentions here. Hydrology folks, the Quasi folks, a consortium of people, have been sort of trying to develop standardized vocabularies because there's lots of people who have water terminologies, and so they have, in this case, I've featured three different things they've done. One, they built sort of a database. That's shown on the upper left here, observations database, data model, relational thing. And it's not much semantics in there. There were sort of tables on units and measures and things of that nature for any particular given item, such as water temperature or acidity of water and so forth. Not much semantics in there. In the middle of the graphic, they essentially created a tool to show some of the terms they were using. But if you look at the structure of the vocabulary in there, they don't have defined relationships very well. They have things like other and so forth. And it's more of a navigational thing than anything else. It's not really a standard vocabulary that's useful except for finding terms that might be applicable. And finally, the last thing on the lower left is their effort at ontology, which is sort of a hierarchy, but it's not a consistent hierarchy. And so what they're calling ontology is really doesn't pass for an ontology. But it does represent sort of people's in the big data realm sort of trying to back into semantics and ontology and recognizing that there's gaps that they have. This is my slide to show the relationship between the tracks, and it's actually been covered. Mike's introduction on that, track B and C already covered some of these relationships. So you heard as much about reuse in the track on obstacles as you might hear within our presentation. So it's highly related, as well as the idea of the data variety track and reuse. So the all this slide adds new is that the idea is that reuse itself is a bottleneck and it's impeded by lack of proper tooling, as has actually been mentioned before. Okay, so one of the evolutions of our discussion has been to include the idea of sharing as well as reuse. So this particular slide makes the point, and this has been part of our discussion online, that shareability, how do you create a semantic artifact that somebody else can is able to reuse is very important as a front end to reuse itself. So that's something that we got into. And we also noted going along that reuse issues are not unique to ontologies and schemas. Indeed, they are very common within the software reuse, and some common problems occur there. And going down to the bottom of this particular slide, why reuse? I've mentioned previously that it's the idea, as in software, is to reduce the developmental effort, expand the benefits, that is, get more return on investment, and try to improve the quality of the original content. Okay, so as we were going along working with the summit organizers, there were some – I'm sorry, I haven't been saying that. Slide 8, thank you. I need help here on that. Slide 8 on broad questions. As we go along, so the organizers sort of had some broad questions and thought that these were some of the things that we should be addressing within our effort. There are four on here. What range of semantic content is being shared and reused on the web? From vocabularies to more formalized and axiomized ontologies. What are the issues with that reuse, which we'll cover in some detail? What ontologies are available, being used, and required? And some of our speakers talked about that. And how can we find these? And that's, again, a topic that was discussed previously in terms of using things like LOV. Around this, these questions, we developed the idea of issues, tools, success stories, and best practices, which will make up some of the latter part of our presentation here today. Okay. As we started, we wanted to get discussion going, so part of the discussion on the forum was important to us, and we've had some very good things. This is slide 9. And so we developed 7 specific track questions. I'm not going to go through reading those, but you will actually some of these were discussed in more detail than the others, but they were an important part of our effort is to get the community discussing things. And for my last slide, before turning slide 10, you have to say the slide number, Mike. This is our list of speakers, starting with Mike, who sort of gave an overview of the track to begin with. I gave an introductory talk on reuse, and all of these, of course, are available online. Pascal Hitzler talked about ontology design patterns, particularly within the EarthCube effort. Andrea, our co-champion here, gave a talk on FIBO and reuse within that. Mike and Megan Katsumi gave a talk on reasoning. Reasoning has been discussed here as something, how important is that? What type of reasoning do we want to have? John Sowick, then that was essentially the speakers for our first February session. Then in March, we had John Sowick giving a overview, including the idea of knowledge sharing. Then Mike Dumontier gave a talk going into big linked open data and provided a lot of biomedical examples that are of interest. And finally, Kingsley Eaton gave a talk, again, on big linked open data. Okay, that's slide 10. Here's slide 11, and here's our co-chair, Mike.
And which button do I press to remind myself to say the number of that one?
Right.
So every time I press that button, I'm going to say the number of the slide.
Okay.
I shall probably forget. So on this middle section, then, I'm going to try and look at what we did to draw together some of the common themes that we saw in those presentations and take a deep dive into a couple of those and basically see what lessons we could pull out, and then Andrew will pick up and consolidate those lessons for us. So just a quick look at some of the common themes, and then I'll do a slightly deeper dive in the next slide. So one thing that I think was clear right from the beginning, really, was, you know, when we talk about ontologies and we talk about what they're for, different people come to it from different perspectives. We heard Matthew earlier about ontologies as a conceptual model in a development life cycle, and that is a very important use of those. Then, of course, there's semantic web-based applications, reasoning, search applications, and so on. So whenever we talk about an ontology, and whether we're talking about reusing it or designing it for reuse or whatever, there's different things that they were originally created for. So I think that was one common theme that informs a lot of the rest of it, including the next question, which I've framed in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way, but nonetheless I think I wanted to put out there, which is, what makes it meaningful? Is it meaningful because you can reason over it, or can you reason over it because it's meaningful? And different people you talk to might have a different, very emphatic answer to that question, or it might be that I'm being slightly cheeky there. But there is the distinction between how you apply knowledge representation theory to think about meaning and apply the way in which, you know, philosophers have thought about meaning for years versus how you apply reasoning and logic and so on to prove that something that you think is meaningful really is, and that you have a usable and reusable ontology. So those different perspectives, again, come back to different usage and so on. Another recurring theme, and we'll have a little slightly deeper dive into this in a moment, is the idea of ontology patterns or ontology design patterns, depending whether you think an ontology is a design thing or an attempt to articulate reality. What is meant by ontology design patterns? How can they be used? How can they be applied, and how do they help in reuse? We'll have a slightly closer look at that in a moment. And another common theme which really ties into all that is what it takes to be able to identify what's reusable. So you're setting out to do some project. You want to not reinvent the wheel. You want to think about reuse of stuff. So here's an ontology that's out there, say, for countries or something. You want to talk about a country. Okay, well, what do I need to know about this? And there are a number of different themes that came over again and again from our different speakers, such as what was the intended scope that ontology was built for? What was its application? So we had, in the hackathon, we had one ontology that was recommended to us that talked about the impact of something or other, but it was specific to the impact of drugs and drug tests, and yet the wording wouldn't have told you that. So what's the intended scope? That tells you what the level of abstractions is going to be. Another common theme was how confident you are in that ontology. Is it well annotated? Is there enough annotation or comments or whatever in the ontology to tell you what the designers of that ontology were actually thinking of when they did that, and therefore what the meanings were intended to be? Another common theme was finding common or similar terms, overlaps, underlaps even, between terms in one or another ontologies. If you're integrating a bunch of ontologies, three of them might have a term for event. Two of them might be framed in the same way, or they might not, which comes on to another common theme, which is in what theory of the world is each of these ontologies framed in terms of? You know, there's maybe two or three different ways of thinking of events. There's different ways of thinking of roles or things performing roles or whatever. And in fact, this is again a common theme that came out, there's no one ontology anyway. So you've got to think about what are the micro theories, and are you trying to reuse something that is maybe not compatible with the micro theory that you're using? And so there's a strategy aspect there, when to use, this really came out more from conversations around the place, in fact, when to use the whole ontology, when to use a snapshot of it, or take an extract, a subset of terms, say you've got a U.S. postal addressing ontology that deals with what goes on an envelope or an American letter, but you actually want to talk about address concepts. You take a small subset of those. How do you deal with that? What tooling do you need to make that happen? And again, another theme that came out of John Sower's talk was, in particular, and others as well, was how you get the right kind of tooling to get the interaction between knowledge workers, logic experts, semantic web reasoning folks, and so on. So, and in fact, there's a lot of best practice stuff in John's slide, which we've shown a link to here, which brings us back to the world of old-fashioned knowledge representation and how we bring that into the the modern era of reasoning and so on. So that was the very, very quick look at the common themes. Next slide, slide 12. I'm going to take a lot less time on the next few, but I just wanted to kind of talk around the sense of what came out of our different sessions. So a slightly deeper dive on a couple of those. So slide 12. When we talked about ontology design patterns or ontology patterns, there was actually a couple of kinds of pattern. When I went back through and looked at all the different presentations, a couple of different things came out. We had a lot of good examples of what I might informally call ontological abstractions, meaningful representations of a concept such as event. So there's a common event pattern. Event is something of a time and a place and certain other things about it. You could take that pattern and extend it and reuse it. But then there's also more, I don't know what the right word for this would be, I've just put axiom patterns, but kind of more designy kind of things, like when to use a string versus when to use a thing, you know, when to use data type properties versus object properties, when to use different partitions to represent stuff, as common modeling patterns, so that in an ontology you might want to reuse, are there common ways they've approached similar problems, not necessarily common semantic abstractions like event, but common kinds of patterns that can be reused to give you some consistency on how the ontology is used. So those two kinds of patterns were of use in thinking about reuse. There's also there was a lot about implementation reuse strategies, looking at the linked data versus the sort of top-down ontology kind of approach, when to derive meaning by examining example data and sort of defining what are the meanings of the concepts in that data and building it from the bottom up, versus when to have common high-level abstractions and patterns like events and so on and work down by extending those, or how to bring it into the middle. We saw some good examples like the trajectory ontology, which was based on event and which could be built out into cruise terms and trip terms and so on. And another issue, this comes back to tooling again, which Andrew will talk more about, is how to be able to integrate. You know, if we're looking at reusing a bunch of ontologies, we'll look at some examples of this just now, there isn't really at the moment the tooling to kind of get different ontologies together and look at the overall system of imports and reuse and what's in what ontology and so on, and be able to develop your kind of integrated ontology solution. And a couple of other things that came out. Ontology has common business language, common meaning for a common point of reference, like vocabularies, but with a much more ontological precision versus common logical expression and so on. And as I mentioned before, how to get the right mix. There's a later slide, so I won't go much on this at the moment, on the interaction between knowledge representation folks and ontology experts and so on, and what tooling is needed to cover that. So very briefly then, slide 13, thank you. I pushed the button and I forgot to say the number. So the next couple of slides really give you a flavor of what some of these things were that came out of those sessions, just to pick up the themes that I just kind of touched on just now. So reuse issues in general then. So to be able to successfully reuse semantic content, i.e. ontologies and, you know, other resources that have some kind of semantics in them, it's important first, excuse me, to understand how the content is being used and what methods are available to be able to coordinate reuse, what tools exist and so on. There's a later slide that picks this up in more detail, the need for tooling for modularity and for getting documentation of the ontologies and so on. And if you look at things like big data and linked data and so on, their ability to make use of existing ontologies and reuse them is somewhat bottlenecked by the paucity of tools that do more than just show you the individual ontology and show you some more integrated view. So reuse then is dependent both on the availability of well-documented ontology content and tooling that supports finding that content and incorporating it into your project, kind of like you would do in conventional technology where you'd have some kind of system view of what you're putting together. So on slide 14, when we talk about reuse, and the next slide covers more of the details of reuse and so on. Ah, thanks. I should have thought of that. Bottle of water. Well, I want us to think about each of these questions from two different perspectives. One that we've focused on so far is you're somebody who wants to reuse some other ontology. What are the things that you need to know or find in order to be able to reuse that? What do I look for? Some of that is ontology quality, but some of it is knowing what that ontology was built for in the first place and know how appropriate it is for what you want. The opposite perspective of that is, what if you're the person who is building an ontology not just for one standalone application, but with the intention of it being reused? So I guess almost by definition, that means you're building a standard, not an ontology for an application. And one thing we found was that some of the decisions that are appropriate to make when you're creating an ontology for one application, where you have neither the budget nor the need to think about some of the broader semantic issues, as long as you can make that application reason and deliver the right results, may be very different to what you have to think about if you want your ontology to be reused by others and become part of some ecosystem of reusable ontologies. So slide 15, then a deeper dive into these reuse conditions, is a couple of things that came out, again, of the different talks and of the conversations on the email and elsewhere. What are the things that are needed for reuse? So firstly, of course, you have to be able to find it. You have to have easily findable and accessible semantic content, i.e. ontologies, has to be documented, and that documentation has to include what were the intended meanings of the terms, in what context, what your use cases were that you intended it to be used for. So if you're reusing something that was built for one application, is there enough documentation for you to know whether or not you can reapply it in your own application? And then you, if you're the one reusing the ontology, what are your competency questions that you want your overall application to answer? What micro theories, I mentioned earlier, you can have different ways of framing concepts. Not all of those ways are mutually compatible with each other. So under what micro theories are you building your solution, and how does that affect what is the ontology you're reusing, and when is it best to reuse content within that development lifecycle for your application? Another critical aspect is that the content is in a form that's conducive for reuse. So far we haven't really talked about different syntaxes, but you know, it may be that the community of practice that owns the knowledge of what some meaning is has framed it in some formalism other than what you might be using. There's a lot of good business semantics out there framed in UML or in Excel or in other things that are not OWL. Of course, you've got to be able to put them in some meaningful form while not losing the business meaning that went into those. Do you know how to do that? Do you know what it takes to get from the one syntax to another? And even if some community of practice has definitively said what is the meaning of some concept that they happen to own, have they done that in a way that's logically consistent? And if so, are the micro theories within which they framed it? I'll give you a simple example of what I mean by micro theories. If you look at time, there's the W3C model, which has interval and instant, and then there's the Allen relations model, which is expressed in the OMG date-time vocabulary, which doesn't recognize the concept of instant. So you can't use both. So you've got to know which of those your ontology is framed in terms of. And finally, do you trust the content and its quality, and do you believe it will be maintained? If not, you might want to take a snapshot of it at a point where it represents what you like, put your own URI into that snapshot or something. And you do need some broadly standard metadata and annotations for all that to work. Okay, I'm running over now. So slide 16, just a couple of quick examples then, just to pull all that together. Schema.org is a very good example of some widely used vocabulary material for describing the contents of a web page. It addresses some of the issues we talked about, right, finding reusable content, managing the size and complexity and so on. It is very much a vocabulary, as we've seen. The concepts are very well documented. It's clear how to use it and so on. So a lot of those things we identified are there. Slide 17, here's an example of what an integrated view between several ontologies would look like. So you've got one ontology which defines a couple of genes as kind of gene, and then another couple on the side there which are more specific to that individual kind of gene. So you can see that because some of the concepts are compatibly defined, you can create a wider view of those. This is from Michel Dumontier's talk, slide 17. Then on slide 18, here's really the questions we looked at for big data, for linked data, but it applies to big data as well. Do you build the ontology first from top down based on well-established design patterns, or do you start from the linked data and then build upwards to extract your ontology from that, or do you do a bit of both and get them to meet in the middle? Kingsley Idahen came up with some interesting ideas here on how part of being able to achieve this balance is to know when to enable or disable inferencing rules on the different available ontology, whether to use those rules conditionally, and not try and think you'll get to something that's absolutely perfect. And slide 19 brings up another research question, which comes back to something we've talked about from the beginning. Are all ontologies needed to be used for reasoning applications, and do you have to be able to reason over it to be able to use it? We heard from the linked data folks that you do. But are the ontologies out there even able to support anything more than the most trivial reasoning problems? Or are they actually designed with not enough formal semantics to support half of what you might want to do if you're reusing the ontology? So those are the kind of questions that came up from Megan Katsumi and Michael Gruninger's talk. So with that, I'll hand over to Andrea. It's slide 20 now. Sorry, I took a bit longer than I expected. But,
you want your water?
Thank you.
Okay. So I get to wrap up in like 5 minutes, so you can all ask questions. Ending part of this talk is kind of about what we learned, and it's not so much, just the questions or a summary, but it's kind of going beyond that to include all the conversations and to start talking about what we learned. Tooling, big thing. I mean, everybody already talked about tooling, but we had some very specific requirements that we discussed. The need for the tools to understand modular technologies, modular semantics, modular components that you want to bring together, and help with that, and help with it in a visual way, not just maybe with using OWL equivalent class. You know, because without visualization, as your ontologies get bigger, obviously, as your set of concepts get bigger, you get blown away by just trying to keep in your head. Nobody can keep in their head all of that kind of information. But governance, that was a really big piece of what somebody needed to be able to trust in ontology. How has it evolved? For what uses has it evolved? Who's taken a look at it? What were the competency questions? I coined a new term on the web, on the email the other day, of using competency queries, that you could actually write your Sparkle queries from your competency questions and execute them, see what happens. And then it's search. And this came up in the NIH talk, too. How do you get the metadata to search, to even find what is equivalent, to find what is useful, and all of those things? And, again, it doesn't have to be a full-blown ontology. It can be a vocabulary. How does the vocabulary, could that inspire a deeper semantic meaning or deeper relationship? So it's not just having a tool that it can import OWL or can import Common Logic, but can actually take a look at Thesauri and schema.org and bring it, things together that can be broadly usable. And one of the comments that John Soa made, which I came kind of from the commercial world, and I worked for like CA, so at the time, you know, doing stuff for IT is kind of important, lining up with the stuff that the programmers use, that the IT departments use, the standard IT tooling would be huge and would kind of open up the space. Because if you say, you know, to the standard IT guys, go learn OWL or go learn Common Logic, you know, no way. But you give them tools and you visualize it and you take a step back from that, that's a huge thing, and that opens up, you know, way more possibilities for the whole world of ontologies and semantics. Some of the tooling we took a look at was the Open Ontology Repository, and there's a lot of good information in there. There's a lot of ontologies in there, but doing more with it, doing more with the metadata, more with the search, more with the visualization, that was one thing. And then, again, lots of people referenced the linked open vocabulary. And some things that we kind of didn't get to, but I still thought we should list as questions. Are there differences between what you need to support the development of these ontologies and schemas, then what you need to use them. And I think there are. And we don't have either, really. We don't even have all the metadata we need. But that's another kind of aspect of the whole tooling that we need to think about. Slide 21, of course, that's your mess of all the possible things that you have out there to choose from. So how do you choose anything from the mess, especially the center of the mess, which you can't even read? Michelle Dumontier commented on how complex everything was and how to coordinate that. It's chaotic and unwieldy. So this came out in some of the earlier slides in this deck, the need for consistent metadata that came out in the NIH talk. And then reuse that's actually affected by user feedback, a recommender system, as it were, to put feedback in place and to actually have that feedback have both a positive and a negative effect, the stick and the carrot, as it were. Then back to the governance. Not just because you publish something doesn't mean it's good. It has to be looked at by other people, commented on. If anybody thinks their first version of something is going to be right, I mean, it's like writing code. I mean, that's why they do Agile. It's not right the first time. Revise it, use it. You know, that's huge, the use part of it. The more you use it, the more you find that you made mistakes or that things could be better. And then acceptance. Be it crowdsourced acceptance, recommender kind of acceptance, or formal acceptance in a standards body or W3C, that is a standards body, but, you know, in a broader group. Some of the other things were, how do you do the knowledge acquisition? John Soa did part of his talk about that. You know, traditionally you get the subject matter expert talking to your knowledge engineer who puts the ideas together. I got 2 minutes. Oh. I got 22 minutes. Oh, slide 22. You got to say that. I was like, victory. Okay, we're getting peace. Yeah. Okay. Using controlled natural languages. The problem with controlled natural languages, other than the good side of it is we can use them. The bad side of it is most normal people never remember all the controls that go into the controlled natural language and make mistakes. Verification testing, that was mentioned earlier, the importance of having a way to test. And that was kind of the last bullet on there, you know, run some predefined Sparkle queries. That's what kind of led me to the competency query part of my email the other day, early this morning, that you can actually do some testing. You can do some verification. Well, my God, if you wrote, you know, an ontology and you can't even pass your own competency questions, clearly something's wrong. But that, again, could be something that somebody could write some simple queries and add to your competency queries to validate ontologies to do more than what you thought or make some minor modifications and then validate them. So these were all things that came up as part of our conversation in Track A, not in all the talks, but in the emails and everything else. Okay. Best practices. I'm not going to read these slides to you. I'm not going to go through all of them. We went from everywhere from upper ontologies to really specific teeny tiny patterns of ontology design patterns with like three classes in them. I think the second major bullet there is what's most interesting. You know, be aware that the way you look at a problem, the way you think about it, the purpose that you use it for, it will affect what you come up with. So one of our recommendations, actually, as part of the governance and everything else, was try to get more than one use, more than one domain view of something. Because clearly, if my kind of thing is a use case of one always works. So if you design something and you have a use case of one thing, of course, you'll address it. But if you're designing something more broadly, try to think of the problem more broadly. And I'm going to push that down arrow. Okay. Modularization, we did talk a lot about that. Other people talked about it. One of the things we had hoped to do more of, which we didn't really get to, was actually collect best practices, collect exemplars, to actually put some concrete pieces of ontologies, patterns, best practices out there and have exemplars of them. But we started to do that, and I won't say we got very far on it, but in the email list we got farther on it too. Understanding in terms of modularization, though, an aspect of that is how does something evolve? How do your pieces evolve over time? How does the pattern maybe evolve over the domain? It might be that the general pattern or the general concept works, but you have to tweak it a little bit for a different domain. Capturing that level of variability or those contexts would actually help or maybe inspire reuse in different areas that someone hadn't even thought of, not only for the original design, but for one aspect of reuse versus another aspect of reuse. And now I'm on slide 25. I forgot to warn you. Okay. Integration. We did talk about integration. This first bullet is kind of valuable to think about, and I think in the hackathon, Mike, that you ran, it came out that if you describe the concepts separate from their encoding and allowed multiple encodings, and then maybe even describe the concepts separate from all their properties, that you could maybe enable more reuse, that this concept might work, but a specific property didn't work or doesn't work. Clearly separating out the axiom patterns, as you called it, from the concept patterns, that's valuable. But we kind of found that the more you separated things out and clearly defined their use, the more reusable things would end up being. It's important in that second sub-bullet on slide 25 there, take care to distinguish what's really definitive. This means X, or this means Y. That wouldn't kind of go into a kind of sub-area of your definition of a concept, whereas this means X in the area of hydrology, that would be appropriate to separate out. So we call that distinguishing the definitive entities from the pragmatic ones. Whether those are good words or not, that's what we called it. Using the integrating modules, which is the equivalent classes, but being consistent. So once you kind of establish a pattern, stick with it and don't jump all over the place. From Michel Dumontier's talk, he said, let's be tactical. And this came back to know your competency questions, know your area, know what you want to achieve, and then steal, reuse from other places to make it happen, but make sure you hit your objective. And in terms of formalizing, and this is for reuse, document everything via well-established labels. We started talking about SCOS and the Dublin Core stuff. Describe why, how something was created, how it's tested, what it was meant to do. These are back to the competency questions. Try to get multiple domains so you actually get multiple use cases. So you look at a problem a little bit more broadly. Plan for evolution, and don't ever think your first pass is right. And then back to this domain and range question, which came up this morning. Take care to use the domains and ranges to clarify what you mean, but don't lock down a meaning. You know, this thing must mean a time instant before you really know that something must be a time instant in the example that you gave of microtheories. And so this came out in the email. Float the domains and ranges when you're trying to be generic, and when you need to be specific, maybe in an application domain, be specific and don't be afraid of it. And naming, this is my last slide, so this is quick. I'm not going to go into a lot about that. There's religious discussions about names and surrogate names versus real names and having meaning or not. I'm just acknowledging there are both approaches. What came out to be important was maybe you do present things in multiple languages, and that's not a bad thing. You can use your labels to do that. And that was kind of the second bullet. Regardless of what your identifier scheme is, make sure that you're addressing all your audiences. And then make sure that you don't pick a name that's overly generic. You know, I picked the name time when I really meant seconds, you know, in the Gregorian calendar past 1972 or something. Don't pick too generic names or too specific names when, you know, be appropriate for the content and the concept that you're actually modeling. So those were our main points.
No, I went off.
please.
Michael Ushold, Semantic Arts. We have heard repeatedly from different talks during the day about this notion of a conceptual ontology versus an application ontology, and the idea that if you can think of it as analogous to in database land, conceptual versus logical versus physical. Now, in database land, the reality is it was a nice theory to do things that way, but once reality got their way, the applications and physical databases evolved, and nobody kept track of the concept. So in the context of, you know, building ontologies commercially for our clients, we advocate this notion of let's do this, but do it right, conceptual kind of, so we call it the middle layer design and the lower layer application ontology. But what we're realizing is over the course of time, initially advocating this idea, and now the reality on the ground is, who's going to do that extra work? That's a lot of extra work, right? And it's hard to tell your client, oh, you need this other one up here, but then we have to keep managing it. So it's just kind of like a little bit of reports from the field. It's nice in theory, just like it was for database, but what's the evidence that it'll ever work in practice? I'd be interested to talk to someone who has experience it working. I began to wonder whether it's actually practical.
And one of the things I would just want to say is if you could improve your tooling so that you did visualize your concept separate from all of the details, that you could actually visualize it from your serialization, that would be valuable. But also if you started to split, here are my main concepts and put it in one ontology that you visualized, and here are all the data properties that went with it in another subset, you might be able to keep your concepts and their key relationships separate and cleaner and better maintained. Of course, you always still end up with the devil in the details of reality.
If I could add, this reminds me of the sustainability issue that we had before. You mentioned ontologies and software have some similar things. Ontologies and data have some similar issues about how to be maintained. So that's one thing, making an investment, trying to get people to recognize the value of the investment. The thing I would add is I do like the conceptual to logical to physical model, but I think more in terms of agile methods now, so that when you're down at the bottom, you go back to the top, because what you're doing down at the application level may change the conceptualization you had before over time. So we should think of this iteratively over time as a sustainable investment.
No, I was just going to very briefly pick up those threads on that. There's really a governance issue there. I think if people are not maintaining some kind of conceptual model in some kind of engineering activity, then it's a false economy because the business is no longer driving what happens. And this really points to the tooling thing. And one thing I don't think we got to mention, but it started to come clear to me, is that you need different kinds of tools for managing ontologies in their published web-facing form, where you have certain disciplines around the URIs and imports and so on, versus the messy world of building the thing. And we do need to have that agile, test-driven kind of approach, which doesn't lose the conceptual. Otherwise, you're out of control and you have a short-term benefit for a long-term disadvantage.
Last question.
It's Terry Longstreth. I'm resonating with Michael's thoughts on this, and I think one of the issues, maybe we want to talk about it next year, is the fact that once you've gotten ontology and you've started to use it, the question is, where are you using it? How are you using it? And how are you keeping track of that utilization? And how does the feedback of that get impacted? When you change your ontology, how many downstream applications do you want to make sure that are kept in sync with that? Or more to the point, how do you know that your downstream applications can even survive with changes? So a lot of this has to do, you know, and that's going outside the ontology realm, because your ontology is just a part of the bigger system.
It's like old-fashioned printed circuit boards. You know, which changes that you made would affect every user and which ones would only affect some. It's a major engineering challenge. I think Andrew had some really good points earlier.
And there's this whole concept of deprecated still there, but deprecated so you can maintain it. And one of the other things I was kind of playing around in Dublin Core and the SCOS, it's the replaces. You know, this thing replaces that thing. So that if you do deprecate it and you do replace something, you actually document what it's replaced by, as opposed to just throwing something new out there and then people scratch their heads.
And somebody raised the issue of multilingual environments. Well, between two languages, you don't have synonyms in many cases.
Thank you.